is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news. The story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it is going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And this hour, we're going to play for you a very, very special tape recording that I did many, many years ago, and then we're going to open up the program at the end for your calls, for your thoughts, for your comments. But I'd like to take you back in time, because you really can't understand anything that's going on today. You can't understand Bill Clinton's recent visit to China. You can't understand all the talk about him being bribed by the Chinese politicians. You know, for a few $100,000, he sold out American policy to communist China. He's simply an agent of the Chinese communists. He's giving Costco and Long Beach to the Chinese communists. We have given the Chinese communists the technology to develop their intercontinental missiles so that they can target American cities. There's a lot of jargon about there. There's a lot of talk, but of course we don't get down to the real nitty-gritty of what this is all about, because people have forgotten history. They don't remember how it was that communism came to China. And so let me take you back to the end of the Second World War. America had won the Second World War, and General Chiang Kai-shek in China was our ally and had been a loyal ally during the war. And so it was that immediately following the Second World War, Eastern Europe went communist. And people were very concerned about that. I mean, we won the war. Why did we give Eastern Europe to the communists? And there was no question that we had. Later it came out that the Yalta Agreement, FDR had agreed that Stalin could take Eastern Europe, and we did everything we could to help him take Eastern Europe. And then, of course, we created the Marshall Plan for Western Europe, supposedly as a counter to the Russian expansion, which we had actually promoted. In fact, we even offered the Marshall Plan, which had been offered to Western Europe to combat communism. We even offered it to the communists. But, of course, those are facts that most Americans have never heard of. And then, of course, China went communist. And there was tremendous unrest. I mean, what we fought for? We fought for to bring freedom to the world. Wasn't that what it was all about? The four freedoms that Churchill and Roosevelt had written about. And in 1949, in January 30th, 1949, a young congressman, his name was John Fitzgerald Kennedy, gave an address in Salem, Massachusetts, in which he said, "Our relationship with China since the end of the Second World War has been a tragic one, and it is of the utmost importance that we search out and spotlight those who must bear the responsibility for our present predicament." It was clearly enunciated on November 26, 1941, that the independence of China and the stability of the national government was the fundamental object of our Far Eastern policy. That this and other statements of our policies in the Far East led directly to the attack on Pearl Harbor is well known. During the post-war period began the great split in the minds of our diplomats over whether to support the government of Chiang Kai-shek or to force Chiang Kai-shek as the price of our assistance to bring Chinese communists into his government to form a coalition. Our policy in China has reaped the whirlwind. The continued insistence that aid would not be forthcoming unless a coalition government was formed was a crippling blow to the national government. So concerned were our diplomats and their advisers with the imperfections of the diplomatic system in China after 20 years of war and the tales of corruption in higher places that they lost sight of our tremendous stake in a non-communist China. This is the tragic story of China whose freedom we once fought to preserve, what our young men had saved, our diplomats and our president have frittered away. And so it is, ladies and gentlemen, that There was very little question in the minds of people in 1949 that the American government had brought communism to China. Now, in 1952, 1951, now there were a series of Senate hearings on the Institute of Pacific Relations, and they were known as the McCarran hearings, and they were trying to find out what had really happened in China, and there, we have a summary of that, and those of you who would like, we'll be glad to send you a few pages from that summary, but basically the summary said this. When General George Catlett Marshall went to China immediately following the Second World War. It was his job to try to bring peace and stability to the warring factions there. And, of course, he was under authorization to force General Chiang Kai-shek into a coalition with the Chinese Communists with the idea that if they two joined together in a common government and they united their armies, then there would be a peaceful solution. Well, of course, General Chiang Kai-shek didn't want to go along with that, and so they set up truce teams made up of an American, a representative of Chiang Kai-shek, and a representative of the Communists, and whenever there was a conflict between the Nationalist Army and the Communists, the truce team would immediately declare a truce, but the Communists, instead of negotiating honestly, would simply regroup and then renew the attack. And so then General Chiang Kai-shek refused to bring the Communists into his coalition government. As a result, General Marshall imposed an embargo on China so that General Chiang Kai-shek could not only not buy weapons anywhere in the world from anybody, he couldn't even get the weapons he had already bought and paid for, which were on Pacific Islands, on Okinawa and other nations, Pacific Islands. In other words, he had bought and paid for weapons, and we wouldn't allow him to have those weapons. And we wouldn't allow him to buy weapons anywhere in the world. Those of you who have heard our interview with Reverend Mellon, who was in China at the time of the communist takeover, will remember he talked about the fact that the Chinese Nationalist Army was retreating 3 weeks ahead of the advancing Chinese Communist Army. What he didn't mention was the reason they were retreating wasn't because they were defeated in battle. They didn't have any ammunition. They didn't have any weapons. Well, Congress at the time was very, very upset about what was going on, and so they authorized General Albert Wedemeyer to go to China. He was a four-star general, probably one of the best-known generals at that time. Those of you who have seen Herman Wouk's docudrama, The Winds of War, and know the story, will remember that there was a general who would dine in the White House and who would dine with Winston Churchill and FDR, and in truth, it really wasn't Robert Mitchum. It was General Albert Wedemeyer in real life, and I had the wonderful privilege of spending several weekends with General Wedemeyer during the interview you're going to hear in just a few minutes, going into the background of the fall of China. Well, General Wedemeyer was sent then by President Truman to China to see what could be done to prevent it from going communist. And he came back with a report which suggested we create a United Nations sort of mandate situation and that we temporarily supervise what was going on there, but we give the arms to Chiang Kai-shek necessary to keep the communists from taking over. And when General Wedemeyer came back with his report, he was asked to modify it, to change it, because it didn't fit in with the State Department's policy. And when he refused to do that, he was told that the president was very pleased with it, but it would be reduced, it would be released to the general public and to Congress at the proper time. Well, the proper time was only long after China had gone communist. The Congress of the United States was very upset with the news coming out of China. It was very obvious the communists were going to take over. So they appropriated $125 million. That would be equivalent of probably $1.5 billion today of arms. And the United States State Department kept those ships laden with arms in ports in San Francisco and Los Angeles for 1.5 years. While the communists took over China. In other words, it was the policy of the American State Department to bring communism to China. And when the ships finally arrived, and you'll find this in the report, which we have and we'll make available to you free of charge, on the fall of China, we call it the Institute of Pacific Relations report, or the McCarran Committee report. When the weapons finally arrived and were given to the generals in northern China, the rifles didn't have any bolts in them. And they were therefore useless. You see, we brought communism to China. Now, then, of course, there was a tremendous uproar. We brought communism to China. How did this happen? Why had we done it? And, of course, then it was very, very important to distract the American people from asking that question. And so the Secretary of State, At that time, it was Dean Acheson in 1950. And Dean Acheson made a speech in which he said, "If South Korea is attacked, we will not defend it." And then the Joint Chiefs of Staff came out with a public statement and said, "If South Korea is attacked, we will not defend it." And for those of you in the listening audience who want to know how you can verify what I'm saying, the speech by John Kennedy or the speech by Dean Acheson or the statement by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's all covered in General MacArthur's book, Reminiscences, and you can just index read for Dean Acheson, John Kennedy, and you'll find shortly after Dean Acheson's speech the facts about the Joint Chiefs of Staff statement. So Kim Il-sung, the dictator of North Korea, having been assured by the American leaders that if he attacked South Korea, there'd be no war, he very, very foolishly attacked South Korea. And, of course, he was then involved in a war that killed, millions and millions of his countrymen. And I'm not justifying him in any means, but I am pointing out that we precipitated that war. And I personally believe it was to distract the American people from asking the question, why? Why was it that we brought communism to China? It's very interesting that immediately the 7th Fleet, the American 7th Naval Fleet, was stationed between Taiwan and the mainland, not to keep the Chinese communists from invading Taiwan, but to keep Taiwan from invading the mainland when the Chinese communists pulled two massive armies off the shores, which they were guarding to prevent a nationalist or Chiang Kai-shek's army from attacking them, and then they could move north into Manchuria to come down into Korea to kill our boys. Now, how did the Chinese communists know that we would not pull the fleet out? How did they know that in 1952, when we had another presidential election, that a good anti-communist wouldn't be elected who would, pull the fleet out? Why was it that we would not allow Chiang Kai-shek to send his boys into Korea to fight rather than send American boys over there to bleed and die in an Asian war? And then, of course, why was it that after the Chinese communists came into the army, came into the battle, that the American government would not allow General MacArthur to retaliate against their supply lines, which was a single rail line through Manchuria? That's the only way they had to bring in supplies. Cut off supplies, you cut off an army. And, of course, General Lin Piao, and he's quoted in this book, MacArthur, Reminiscences, and it's also quoted in another book, MacArthur's Rendezvous with Destiny, written by Major General Courtney Whitney. But General Lin Piao, and let's see if I can find the exact quotation, General Lin Piao, who commanded the Chinese Communist Army, which attacked our boys and killed them, said this: "I would never have made the attack and risked my men and military reputation if I had not been assured that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from taking adequate retaliatory measures against my lines of supply and communication." That comes from page 375 of MacArthur's Reminiscences. Let me repeat that. This is what the Chinese general said: "I would never have made the attack and risked my men and military reputation if I had not been assured that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from taking adequate retaliatory measures against my lines of supply and communication." How could it be that General Lin Piao knew something that General MacArthur, our commanding general in Korea, didn't know? Well, of course, you have to understand there's always been a very close working relationship between the people who really control China and the people who really control America. And it has nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans. For as Senator Barry Goldwater said in his book, With No Apologies, on page 279, and of course his book was written in 1979, he said, "Since the end of the Second World War, we've had 4 Democratic presidents and 3 Republican presidents, but other than the first 7 years of the Eisenhower administration, it hasn't really mattered which party controlled the White House, because the same foreign and domestic policy always continues." In other words, we always continue the move towards one world government and one world socialism. Well, I had the unique opportunity of interviewing General Albert Wedemeyer, and you're about to hear my interview with General Wedemeyer. And so without further ado, let's hear, and this, of course, is an interview that was taped back in 1980, but you're going to hear history being recounted here by a man who lived it.
Do you feel that General Chiang Kai-shek would have been able to have brought freedom, to have brought democracy, to have brought a better way of life to the Chinese people, had he been able to maintain his control over China?
Well, that was definitely his objective. He was a very fine Christian gentleman, in my judgment, although the image of Chiang Kai-shek had been changed a great deal from the period of the war and then after the war. In our various information media, one found that he was denigrated and referred to as a warlord again, whereas he was a hero on a white horse during the war when we needed him. He did definitely state again and again his worthy objectives of creating opportunities, enabling his people to enjoy freedoms they'd never enjoyed before, and to have opportunities of improving their minds and certainly their way of living. He had a terrific responsibility, and I think that he needed outside help from nations that were his friends, especially the United States. We were historically the best friend of China.
Now, what actually happened when General Marshall went to China?
Well, I read the General Marshall's directive from President Truman. I read it the day he arrived because he was interested to obtaining my reaction. It required him to amalgamate the nationalist Chinese, they call it the Kuomintang, and then the Communist Party, Chinese Communists, and then the intellectuals. There were three categories required by this directive to be brought together in a common effort to maintain peace there. And he made, General Marshall made a strenuous effort to accomplish this. In fact, he said to me, when I reacted to this directive, I said, "General Marshall, I doubt seriously that you can ever do this. The Nationalist Party has most of the power, and they're not going to relinquish one iota of it. The Communists are determined to get the power here, and they have, unfortunately, the help of Moscow Chinese. And the help of Communists in Moscow during the war was more or less surreptitious. After the war, it was overt and openly they were helping the Chinese Communists, giving them arms and equipment and giving them moral support. The third category, the intellectuals, they were very small in number and they had very little influence, although the Chinese historically have a great deal of respect for a scholar. Scholarship is a very important facet of Chinese life.
Now, what was the military situation in China at that time, at the time when General Marshall arrived?
Yes. Of course, Chiang Kai-shek was determined, as I stated, to create conditions, opportunity for his people. Now, he had to go back and recover and rehabilitate the eastern one-third of China. That is, along the littoral, the seacoast and so forth. His military were well-trained, quite well-trained, and they were moved. He asked me to move them as rapidly as I could up into Manchuria, where the Communists had been quite active. And I did this, made vast movements by air transport. And I moved them into the vicinity of Mukden and Harbin. The Chinese were more or less fed up with war, and it's understandable. I think basically they are a peaceful people. They certainly are dedicated to the family, and while Confucianism is not a religion, it's a wonderful philosophy of life and very much of the teachings of Christ you'd find from Confucian philosophy. He had a difficult problem to bring back opportunities for work and for shelter.
What was the function of General Marshall's mission to China?
General Marshall received a directive from President Truman in 1945 to proceed to China and bring about an amalgamation of the conflicting forces there. The Nationalist Chinese, known as the Kuomintang, the Communist Chinese, and the intellectuals. The Nationalist Chinese, of course, had most of the power at the end of the war, and they were determined to retain that power and cope with any internal dissensions and any defections instigated by the Communists to the north. The Communists, on the other hand, were greatly heartened by the support they were receiving during the war surreptitiously, but after VJ Day, after peace was declared, they began openly to give them arms and equipment and moral support.
That was the Russians were giving it.
The Moscow communists were giving open support to the Chinese communists, yes. Our Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, almost concurrent with this situation, announced that we were going to let the dust settle before we continued to give the usual assistance to our loyal wartime ally, the National Chinese. So the situation that confronted the Generalissimo was very precarious. Here he was with a people who were tired, war-weary, 8 years of sacrifice, 8 years of disarray, everything, their economy and everything had been in disarray. So he wanted to stress creating peaceful conditions throughout the land, and he abhorred the use of force where he could use peaceful means to rehabilitate and to reconstruct China proper.
Now, did General Marshall try to bring about a coalition?
After he reported to the Generalissimo, indicating his objective in China, General Marshall suggested a committee of three with representatives from the Nationalist government, a representative from the communists, and then himself. This committee of three would determine how to maintain the peace while resolving the dispute between the communists and the nationalists.
And what happened when the coalition government did not come about, this committee did not come about? What was General Marshall's program?
Well, of course, he would strive to hold meetings and arrive at agreements, but the Chinese communists would betray trust and violate agreements without fail. And this shocked General Marshall. He was so favorably impressed initially, he told me, by Zhou Enlai being the number two communist leader. Zhou Enlai was a charming individual. He's a fine-looking man, and his English was quite voluble and quite versatile, and he was cunning. His charm was turned on, but his heart and his mind were elsewhere. He was determined, of course, to overthrow the country. Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong often stayed with me in Chongqing during the war, and I had read Das Kapital, both volumes, in German, so I was fairly knowledgeable about communism. And I discovered that neither one of them really understood communism themselves, as Karl Marx and Hegel and other communists, Lenin, the way they were implementing it in Europe at all. They had other ideas, but they were utilizing communism as a vehicle to seize power. And it was a very interesting experience to me to talk to these two Chinese communist leaders and find that they were not carrying out the basic ideas or ideals, if you could call them that, of European communism or Moscow communism. Stalin and so forth had an entirely different concept.
Now, why did America impose an arms embargo on nationalist China?
Well, that was to be a lever that that General Marshall used to compel the nationalists to agree to accede to the demands of the Chinese communists. The Chinese communists wanted to be part of the army, and they wanted to have representatives in their diet, their huge assembly. In other words, they wanted to be participating actively in the laws of the land and also have the means of maintaining order at their beck and call. Now, Marshall strove to do that, but the nationalists wouldn't agree to that. As long as the Chinese communist, a so-called political party, had arms, Generalissimo would not agree to their adoption and their amalgamation with his own forces.
When did General Marshall impose the arms embargo on nationalist China?
Well, it was during these discussions in the fall of 1945 and the spring of 1946.
And what was the reason for the imposition of the embargo?
I cannot account for the policy that was adopted immediately after World War II. However, Dean Acheson, who was Undersecretary of State at the time, did decide that the United States would let the dust settle before making arms and wartime equipment available to the Chinese.
But certainly, weren't the Chinese communists well equipped? Weren't they getting equipment from Russia?
Definitely, of course. Moscow was furnishing arms and equipment to the Chinese communists openly, covertly, and they made available, for example, a lot of the ammunition and equipment that was taken from the Japanese after the war was over. And consequently, the Chinese communists were given a definite advantage over the nationalist Chinese due to that development.
And what was the effect of the arms embargo upon the nationalist Chinese?
Well, gradually, the Chinese nationalists were in short supply of ammunition for their guns and for small parts. For example, we had 17,000 4x4 trucks over there, and a little part would immobilize the truck so that they couldn't move their troops around, and they were really rendered rather impotent before the face of this well-equipped and exultant, you might call, enthusiastic group of Chinese communists who were coming down from the north, and they very quickly conquered China that way. The poor Chinese were terribly demoralized. Here was a traditional friend that let them down at a critical time in their history.
Now, if you read Dean Acheson's book, Presence of the Creation,
he
mentions that there was no incident where the Chinese nationalist troops didn't have enough ammunition and lost the battles. Was that true?
Well, of course, I hesitate to question any government official. I never question a government official's loyalty, certainly. I leave that up to the FBI. But I'm compelled to question judgments. And I don't know the information upon which he based that statement, that the Chinese nationalists had plenty of equipment to fight successfully. I just don't know where he got that information. I had on the spot reports from officers whose judgment I could trust, of course. They had no objective in not reporting honestly, and they told me that the Chinese nationalists were very greatly in short supply of ammunition for their guns, again, and for the equipment in general to use it. And most of the equipment that the Chinese nationalists were using was American equipment. I don't believe Dean Acheson's statement was correct. I just don't think it was. And I believe, of course, that he thought it was correct. He was getting that information from people who were liberal or inclined in the leftist way over there in China. A lot of the press, we had left-leaning liberals over there in the press.
How long was the arms embargo maintained?
Well, it continued on indefinitely as a policy, but gradually the Chinese nationalists did get authority to purchase equipment from our country, and there were several discriminatory acts that I'm thoroughly familiar with. Namely, we would charge the Turks about $10 for a carbine. We'd charge the nationalist Chinese $100. So the Chinese were not too rich at that time after fighting a war for 8 years, but that's just one incident. They did, and then when they did fulfill a requisition for equipment and arrange to buy a lot of arms, they delay the arrival of it out there so that they didn't get it there in time to use it against the communists. These kind of things were not brought out to the American body politic. They're known by quite a few people who were just trying to protect American interests as well as the interest of a loyal ally to Japan.